Hello, everybody, and welcome to a Friends with Fantasy Benefits Concept podcast. I am Chuck Anderson. I can be reached on Twitter at Just Chucking It. And great up Norte, Andrew Dewhurst is with us. Andrew, what's your Twitter handle? And let's get rolling.
Hey, you can find me at Andrew K. Dewhurst.
That's all good stuff, my friend. I guess I almost have to apologize for the concept today because I know I'm sort of reiterating or attacking the same point a different way on multiple occasions. But I have my reasons for it, and the player list for today is something where I'm going to be asking Andrew a lot of questions about players and about how we try to evaluate and forecast players. The concept for today is fantasy baseball is getting less and less predictable, and modern metrics are playing a role in that, in so much as they haven't helped in predicting player performance. I think there would be sort of a sharp rebuttal to this by people in the analytics world, but it's my natural contrarian views that when somebody breaks out, when for every Nick Pivetta that breaks out, we have seemingly one or more guys that we just cannot figure out why they're struggling so bad. I'm going to point to an example this offseason. I was really high on a guy, Jacob Faria. You know, and he doesn't have the most prototypical arsenal that you would see in a stud, but he was coming off really, really good stats last year, very young, 24 years old, had basically always been very successful in the minors. And, I took Jacob Faria as my fifth starter in a league, and it was widely hailed by the people in the FWFB staff chat. One such person is Evan Peterson, which I don't know if you guys listened to me when I used to work with Evan, but Evan can come up with some stats that you just don't see everywhere. And Evan stated that Jacob Faria was in the top four of pitchers in Major League Baseball last year in domination of lineups the third time through the lineup. And he used that as extra support of my pick and telling me exactly, you know, how many good things were probably in store for Jacob Faria. Well, Jacob Faria stands as the 115th pitcher on that starting pitcher eligible on the ESPN player rater right now. And I'm suggesting that last year, that even looking up a stat going off 14 games started last year, is we create analysis by paralysis by going off of such small sample sizes. There's basically not a stat right now that looks close to as good as those 15 appearances last year that included 14 starts of Jacob Faria. And like I said, we're going to go through a lot of different players today, and I'm going to have different angles at which I'm frustrated with statistical analysis. So what do you think of today's concept? Are you tiring of my different angles at the same issue?
Not as of yet, at least. I think I wholeheartedly agree. I think we do have a lot of paralysis by analysis and advanced metrics. I mean, my first thought is more and more we grow too reliant on like looking at advanced metrics and throwing away the eye test. Instead of using advanced metrics to point us to where we need to use the eye test. And it leads to, I mean, the thing about pitchers like Jacob Faria is at the place you're taking it, you're throwing darts like everybody else. You know, it's there's no guarantees, and if especially on a 14 start pitch sample. So, I mean, the magical thing about this whole process is that, you know, it's 182 games. What goes up must come down, and what goes down will also come back up. So it's, you know, it's a process, and it's one that will try your patience over and over and over again.
Well, my patience has sort of reached its limits here, in case you haven't noticed. You know, like Nick Pivetta is a great example to me. You know, a guy who had shown stuff but hadn't really shown any true refinement of his ability to be able to pitch. Well, now he seems to be in the midst of a breakout, and the steps that it took for Nick Pivetta to get better versus like the steps that it's taking for Sean Newcomb, you know, these things, it just seems like because of the humanness of what we're dealing with, they're going to go through this process, as you like to say, they're going to go through this process at completely different, at different times, in different ways. And we have this other shining example out there right now, which is Jordan Lyles, which by the time Jordan Lyles has had his sort of mini breakout into fantasy relevance again, I mean, Jordan Lyles, if he was drafted in an NFBC league this year, I mean, congratulations to whoever did it. Okay, but that's 750 picks deep. 750 picks deep, okay? And I see him as better than, like, my last five starters, you know, the Matt Stroms of the world that I took, you know, the guy from Musgrove, I think it is. I mean, these guys, you know, these guys were taken at pick, before pick 350, and they've been completely and utterly useless. So when you get trapped, and this just may be a lot, today might be a lot of Andrew talking me off a cliff, and I want I want everyone to realize that ahead of time. And I'm not having the world's most dreadful year. I've got four of my seven leagues are quite competitive. But the other three leagues happen to be very important to me, so it's been weighing on me. So let's try and go through some of these players that I picked out today, and it was a combination of things. I had some questions as to how these players could be performing how they are, either really well or really poorly. And I haven't heard a lot of mention of them and what they're doing right now. And the first player I want to talk about is Ian Kinsler, who was a very stylish late game sleeper at second base, considering that he was, you know, switching teams from a team that was rebuilding to a team that appeared to be going for it with what they accomplished in the offseason. And that, of course, is the Los Angeles Angels of Anaheim. Now, Ian Kinsler, I haven't heard spoken about much, but Ian Kinsler has been absolutely dreadful. I can't really point a reason to it. He doesn't appear to be hurt. Are you as frustrated with Ian Kinsler as I am? And, there's this really weird metric going on that he cut his strikeout rate by nearly 5% while his walk rate has gone up and his stats look pretty bad. So what do you think, Andrew? Where are we with Ian Kinsler right now?
Well, I mean, personally, I'm not frustrated with Ian Kinsler because I don't own a single share of Ian Kinsler, because by the time I did most of my drafts, his stock had risen so much that I'd gotten priced out on it. But it looks like the largest reason for Ian Kinsler's dreadful season so far is he's teams are shifting him at an incredible rate. Like, he's now being shifted almost 40% of the time because he's hitting it, he's pulling the ball or hitting it up the middle 80% of the time. So that combined with his increased ground ball rate, which is up, I think something like 8%, is leading to him performing, you know, it's leading to a 202 average. I mean, his BABIP isn't helping, but that's going to be partially a product of all those ground balls, as he's hitting just 211, like his BABIP's at 211. So, I mean, Ian Kinsler's not a bad hitter, right? Like, his soft contact is down. He's, you know, it's largely become medium contact. but he's just a guy you're going to have to be patient with. And in 12-team leagues and shallower, he's just not going to be on your roster. You don't have a reason to be that patient with him. But 15-team plus, you're probably going to wait it out and try something else off the garbage heap if you can. But, I think it's going to come around. You know, I would guess by the end of the year, he'll be up closer to 260 and in the average department, and you'll still get your, you know, probably only going to get maybe 15 home runs. And if you're lucky, 20 steals, which isn't the excitement maybe we were looking for.
Well, I think part of what is registering with me right now is the 18 runs plus RBIs combined to this point. I think, you know, in a better lineup, we were hopeful for a lot more than that. Now, he only had 52 RBIs last year, but realize that right now he's on pace for like 30. I mean, that's like unthinkably bad. And like I said, some of the metrics should think, you know, a slight increase in walk rate with a 33% dip in K rate, you would think would be pretty good. Now, the 211 BABIP is, you know, can partially or largely be attributed to some of what, you know, a lot of what Andrew is telling us about the shift. But also, you know, last year he was a 244 BABIP guy, and he is 35 years old. So, I think Andrew gave us his opinion that he sees a bounce back coming. But I wanted to point out Ian Kinsler because I think his truly dreadful, like, fantasy team sinking kind of performance that he's had so far, if you add up the counting numbers, the lack of power, if you add, you know, the horrendous batting average, I mean, we're talking about he's got a 283 OBP. You know, he just has never, you know, he's never been like this before. And we had, you know, eons of data on him. You know, you're talking about a guy who has been in the bigs since 2006. So, you know, it's a shocking plummet. And I guess we have to wonder now if Ian Kinsler just literally hit the cliff or if he didn't. And if he's going to grow less stubborn, because I would assume a hitter who's seen as much pitching as him could start to maybe go the other way and beat the shift a little bit more. He's not the prototypical guy. He's not Joey Gallo, who's like, oh, any pitch I can drive over the fence, so there's no reason for me to care if they put their entire roster on the left, you know, on the right side of the diamond. You know, he's not that guy. So there's multiple reasons to be frustrated here, I think. So
yeah, and at the end of the day, though, Chuck, I mean, if Kinsler gives you 70 runs scored, 70 RBIs, and goes 15-15 with a 260 average, how disappointed are you going to be?
Well, I would just like to point out that he's not on pace for 70 runs or 70 RBIs, not even close.
Yeah, but I mean, like, we're a good – he's at five. Like, we're a good – he could easily, like, practically triple his RBI rate in a week, right?
Yeah, I guess that is conceivable. But, maybe, like I said, you know, if I'm basing my argument about against analytics on small sample sizes, maybe 33 games is a tad bit unfair. And there's also the chance that, you know, you run through all these things, you know, stats can be looked at a number of different ways. Well, so can sort of the eye test. A lot of people right now would say that maybe he's been pressing too hard with a new team and that he hadn't really done that, you know, since, you know, he hadn't done that in the last 5 years. So, you know, since he moved from the Rangers to the Tigers.
Yeah, I would also contend that maybe some of the excitement was a bit overhyped. Like, if you compare last year's Tigers order, like that starting nine to this year's Angels rosters, you know, that starting nine, I don't think one is actually that much better than the other. I mean, outside of one having Mike Trout, I think a lot of the other, you look at the rest of those players and it's probably much of the same. So I think in some cases, if we were looking at being like, wow, he's going to be on a better team than what the Tigers would have been this year. Yes. But last year's Tigers roster wasn't completely devoid of offensive talent.
All right. Well, let's go from a 35-year-old middle infielder, which a lot of you know, especially if you read my Of Note column last year, that middle infield really frustrates me like no other area of the diamond. And part of it is always the fact that minor league scouts love slick fielding middle infielders, and they have a tendency to get to the bigs really, really young. One of my success stories this year is my shares of Ozzie Albies, and it got to the point with middle infielders last year that Albies, despite being the youngest player called up in the bigs last year, was before September, it got to the point where people were writing him off and saying he had very little chances of being even a top 25 second baseman this year. And to this point, he's been a top 25 player. so there, and Francisco Lindor is another one I always point to, considered a strong glove guy with very little bat, very little hit tool upside, who is now maybe a top 15 player. So there's some frustration that goes into this. And one of the guys that I thought was on the verge of a breakout this year, and he is bouncing back a little bit, is Ketel Marte. And I used part of my impetus for this was the fact that he got signed to a contract extension by a team that doesn't usually do this with its players. And as a Diamondback, and I thought that's all the Diamondbacks were suppressed in value going into the season because of the humidor. But there's been some good things recently with Ketel Marte, but I think in shallower leagues, people probably dropped him by now. Where are you on Ketel Marte right now?
He's definitely one that I'm a little bit confused about. His hitting profile, like, he runs well. He makes contact 91% of the time. He hits a lot of ground balls, but, for a player that runs well, that's not necessarily a bad thing. But he's just hitting .223. And his BABIP's just .254. I would expect a player that runs as well as Ketel Marte to have a BABIP in the 310 to 320 range, not in the 250 range, which is, that combined with the amount of contact he makes should lead to better results than what he's had. So, he's a player you'd like to see walk more. He doesn't strike out a bunch. So, I don't know. I'm somewhere between there's still lots of room for breakout to happen. I mean, he does have twice double the RBIs of Ian Kinsler. but at the same time, you have to wonder, is this going to be just an extremely bland profile for Ketel Marte? The advanced numbers say that I think it should be better, but at the same time, I guess when you're hitting the ball on the ground 60% of the time, you're probably going to hit into a lot of ground outs.
Well, he has hits in 9 of his last 12 games, which is certainly a good thing. Some of the variables around him, a guy we'll talk about later, Paul Goldschmidt, some of the variables around him are not what we thought they were going to be either. They haven't had Jake Lamb. So it's definitely been a very odd sort of season for him. And one of the games he just pinch hit in. So you can take that to 10 of his last 12 starts. He's had a hit in. So I think he is starting to bounce back. My frustration with Marte is that the profile couldn't have looked like it took a larger step forward than it did last year. I mean, last season you saw him jump up to a guy with a .345 OBP despite a .260 batting average, which, like you say, his profile, his contact rate doesn't lead you to think he's a .260 average guy to begin with. So it seemed like there was a chance that he was going to be, say, a 360 kind of OBP guy on a team that I still thought, had a pretty decent offensive profile, ability to do well offensively. So Ketel Marte is on the bounce back. We definitely need to see some more hitting the ball in the air. I think he is suitable right now. He's played well enough recently that you can use him as a middle infield replacement in shallower leagues if you need somebody for a couple weeks, especially if they're on the road and they just started a road trip now. So let's watch Ketel Marte very closely going forward. Andrew, the next guy I want to talk about is Jesus Aguilar, if you will. And Jesus Aguilar, of course, is near and dear to me being a Brewer. And I always felt like he would have a very good chance to break out if he got regular at bats. Now, the 27-year-old Aguilar finally had a bad game yesterday, but he was red hot over the weekend. Do you think that the run that Aguilar is on, which includes really leveling out his splits against different-handed pitchers, do you think Aguilar is a fantasy option and a fantasy value going forward despite a jammed roster in Milwaukee?
Well, as long as he's playing, I think he, like, if he's going to be playing consistently right now, he needs to be owned. His hard contact, medium contact are really high right now. Like 40% hard contact, 48% medium contact, just 11% soft contact. So he's scorching the ball right now. At least that's what the statistics tell me. Hitting the ball in the air a lot, which is likely leading to, his 7 home runs so far in a limited number of at bats. Things are probably as good, might be as good as they're going to get for him right now. I think, the average is going to come back with extended playing time. Like he's not going to, I don't think he's going to be a 320 hitter. But the rest of the profile looks pretty good. Like 9% walk, 22% strikeout. If you've been playing him right now, you've definitely been reaping those rewards.
Yeah, and in comparison, by the way, for a guy who didn't play a lot early in the season, he has 20 runs and 20 RBIs, compared to 13 runs and 5 RBIs for Ian Kinsler. I have once I saw the injury to once I saw the injury to their Korean first baseman to Eric Thames. Once I saw that, I jumped
Hold
on it.
on. So when did Eric Thames become Korean?
Oh, well, I'm sorry. He from his Korean product coming back from Korea. That's a good point. I don't know what he calls home these days, but I'm imagining he doesn't really call himself Korean. That's a good point. But the point being, once I saw the injury to Thames, I really decided that that I had to have him as a fill-in. Just assuming that a combination of Domingo Santana being performing so poorly this year, which is a guy who could have been on this list, and Ryan Braun's injury history, that he could really fall into a lot of at bats. And playing in 15 and 18 team leagues like I am, he's really, Jesus Aguilar had really saved me. Like I said, I've heard other outlets talk exactly about how his splits just are not at all what people thought they were going to be. They thought he was basically a specialist, and a lot of his production coming off the bench last year was due to him being used, largely against left-handed pitching. When he was hooked up with Thames as, a backup, that made a lot of sense. But right now, he's raking against both sides of the plate. Both sides of the hurling hurlers that are throwing at him. So there's a lot to be said for him. I do think he's due to cool off a little bit. I've always felt like he would get exposed at least somewhat if he was used on a regular basis. He did not look as good last night, and you also have to worry about a little more fatigue than maybe he's used to. He's a big, strong guy, and he's just ripping the bejesus belts out of the ball almost every time he hits it, and he's hitting right in the middle of their lineup. And it's a lineup with good table setters in front of it, the non-Ian Kinslers of the world right now. You know, the Lorenzo Cain and Christian Yelich, to be exact, kind of players are hitting in front of him. So I'm excited for and about Jesus Aguilar. I do wonder what's going to happen. I have not heard of Thames going on a rehab yet anywhere, so he's got at least a couple more weeks to cement his role, and I think he's doing a hell of a job thereof. But he was someone, too, that was an afterthought. I drafted him in one of my NFBC leagues late, thinking he might get traded as part of a deal for a pitcher before the season started. He's also a guy last year coming out of spring training. He ripped up spring training last year to no end. And people here were excited. And I naysayed everyone. I said, well, they just got Thames. They don't have a roster spot for, you know, a right-handed hitter who doesn't run well that can only play first base. How would they even keep him on the roster? The Milwaukee regime has been smarter than me, and they are reaping the rewards for it right now. Let's talk about another confounding hitter, and this one in your ballpark, Andrew. Let's talk about Justin Smoke, who will lead me to talking about, wanted to pick out two first basemen, is we have these bizarre breakouts now in back-to-back years at first base. How we're going to go forward trying to figure out which endgame first baseman we really want. So, first of all, seeing a lot of Justin Smoke, there's been like a miniature bounce back lately. I certainly think you were hoping for a lot more home runs if you drafted him, and like I drafted him. So, where are you on Justin Smoke right now, and what do you think's going on here?
I think Justin Smoke is probably like, yeah, I mean, you're not getting 8 home runs yet last year. But, I mean, more or less, what he's doing is pretty close to what he did the previous year. His OBP is actually up from the previous year. The slug's down to, I mean, obviously, he wasn't good. I mean, unless he was going to finally hit that full-on, like, stud status that was to be expected. I mean, I think you're getting what you paid for. He's going to probably hit, almost probably hit around 30 home runs. The lineup around him has also been up and down. Like the Blue Jays at one point in the year were scoring the most runs in baseball. Lately, they've not been able to score any runs. So, I mean, the counting stats are going to suffer along that way. But, I mean, he's on pace for, basically like 90, over 90 RBIs again. And probably almost 90 runs to go along with 20, like what would be a 28 home run pace. So, I mean, you're going to take that. Yeah, he was outside the top 100, walking 15% of the time. I don't think there's too much to be concerned. I would be concerned about with Justin Smoke is what is that lineup going to look like around him? The Blue Jays continue to go into a tailspin, and I'm sure for those who listen to this podcast, you've heard me say this enough, this team is going to sell. Is Justin Smoke going to be sold? Is he going to be left standing around? But those are questions that I don't have the answer to, but it just leads to some risk in counting stats. So, you may see the runs decrease, the run pace decrease, you may see the RBI pace decrease. You'd certainly like to see a little bit better than 252 for the average, and you still might. Overall, I think he's, if someone's looking to sell him in deeper leagues, I think there's reason to buy because he may go to a better situation or the situation around him may stay the same. So, I mean, those sound like numbers I want to have with players. So, that's where I'm at with them right now.
I think maybe the 6 home runs is only disappointing in so much as he was on pace last year for more of like 40 home runs. And also I think some of the other end game first basemen that you had to pass on have exploded, the Brandon Belts of the world. which is why I wanted to take a second and talk about first base strategy going forward. Do you think there's anything we can find predictive? Because, you know, Justin Smoak and Ryan Zimmerman were and Yonder Alonso were all guys that we, you know, we sort of felt like had really taken mammoth steps forward. Their entire profiles last year, though, you know, weren't all the same. They weren't always consistent. Like Yonder Alonso was not nearly as good at the end of the year last year. So maybe that's the difference here. What are the things that you're going to be looking for in an endgame first baseman? How would you try and predict next year's Brandon Belt, Andrew?
Well, I won't. To be fair, here's what I think is important and common among the three players. Smoak and Alonso came out of absolute nowhere last year. Huge. Suddenly they were the players that people were always looking for them to be, but they'd never done it before. Brandon Belt looks like he's having that year this year. So what we end up with is the following year, a lot of guessing at draft day. We don't know, like, is this for real? Is this not for real? Is the swing change going to continue to, are they going to give us this kind of home run output? What are we going to get from these guys? So, I mean, I think there's a reason to say these guys should be avoided if possible for something for players maybe who are more predictable. Or if you think you're willing to roll the dice and draft one of these guys outside of the top, you know, 150 or something, then, you know, roll away. But you probably would be well advised to make sure that you've got an insurance policy somewhere. Or maybe you're smarter to, you know, depending on what the draft day cost is, to try, you know, best two out of three, you know, overdraft first base or your corner infield and see what you get out of it. Because maybe you'll get Brandon Belt. Maybe you'll get Logan Morrison. Maybe you'll get Justin Smoak. Who knows? I think there's just not, there's not enough predictability into it, because when you have a breakout into your, you know, when you're into your early 30s, it's harder to imagine it being sustainable, because we don't necessarily have as good of understanding of it.
Well, I guess my mind is sort of looked at it this way. My mind is in agreement with you, but maybe is taking it a step further, partially because of league depth. You know, with NFBC leagues, when you have 50-man rosters, that I think you can work your early picks so you can take two or three late game gambles at first base. My gut tells me that that's become a good idea now. And I mean that in so much as, you know, if you use roster flexibility, if you get some certainty, as much certainty as you can out of your relief pitchers, maybe you can wiggle two extra picks on late game plays. And what I've seen, what I'm going to group these players together as, with Smoak, Alonso, Zimmerman last year and Belt this year, is that we've always known that these players could break out. we always knew that they could have really good stretches. They had the pedigree, they had, different parts of the hitting profile were sort of always there. They'd gone on a bit of a hiatus from when they were very good. And so I think my approach is that I want to take two more gambles, end game gambles on players like this next year. Do you think that's viable?
Yeah. I mean, I think it's certainly, I think if there's some reason to go down that route. I mean, just think about this. These are your top 10 first basemen according to the ESPN player rater right now. Freddie Freeman, Brandon Belt, CJ Cron, Jose Abreu, Hanley Ramirez, Joey Gallo, Jose Martinez, Rhys Hoskins, Eric Hosmer, and Joey Votto. Just think about that grouping of names. These were no one's top 10 first baseman. Not like, not in this order, at least. And no one was putting Belt in that conversation. No one's putting Crone in that conversation. No one was. We didn't even think Hanley Ramirez was going to play. I mean, like, and you've got guys like, you know, seemed like sure things like Anthony Rizzo at 25, Edwin Encarnacion at 26.
You're avoiding the Goldschmidt.
Goldschmidt's at 37. like if I told you right now that you would have been better off having Nico Goodrum in the first 40 games of the year instead of Paul Goldschmidt, you would have laughed me out of the room on draft day. John Hicks is ahead. Like that's the place that we're at right now. But we also have to remember we're only a quarter of the way through the season. And I will bet you that sure as anything that things will look closer to where we expect them to be come the end of the year.
Well, I am finding it very, very difficult to navigate the water at first base over the last couple years. And I definitely have had some frustration, and that's despite me owning some shares of Ryan Zimmerman last year. And, you know, like you said, smoke really hasn't been all that bad. I do own CJ Crone in two leagues, which is probably in considering that they're leagues where you weren't going to be able to pick people up during the season. That's a pretty good portion of leagues to have a piece of a guy like CJ Crone in, and that was sort of opportunity in getting away from Anaheim that I saw with Crone. But you're right. I mean, Freeman and Abreu were taken relatively early, but most of the player and Votto, who's at the bottom of the list, but of the top 10, but most of those guys are not who we thought they were. And maybe this unpredictability in first base is something that we need to think is going to happen now. And maybe that's the most, these are the players that are going to be the most volatile within the launch angle revolution. Just because, generally speaking, they're not speed guys. So what we're looking for is, you know, outbursts in power is largely what we're looking for. And we're looking for, you know, RBIs and run production. Which sort of goes hand in hand with the home runs. So CJ Crone's a guy who could have been on this list as well. He's been a little bit crazy lately, even though I noticed he's finally slowed down for a couple games now. Well, let's talk about a guy who a Cuban import that everybody thought was going to really go through the minor leagues quickly, and we thought he was sort of the base of the Cubs revolution that has happened in recent years. But instead of that being what's happened, we've really seen Jorge Soler go on an odd road the last few years. So he fell out of favor in Chicago, got traded to the Kansas City Royals, which I was a person who was really high on him going into last year, figuring that he had gotten bored in the upper minors and some of the steps back in his hitting approach would iron themselves out with more playing time. And by and large, last year was a completely useless year for him, a throwaway. But he rebooted this year, and he's really on my list for an extra reason that I see he's really moved up in the lineup lately, which, you know, there's a huge vacuum in that lineup. But again, this is a player, you know, some of his improvements are fueled by a 375 BABIP. So I wonder how real you think the improvements are for Jorge Soler, and do you think we're talking about him next year as a top 25 outfielder? You think that's possible?
It's possible, but I don't know if it's plausible. I mean, the average is coming down, right? Like, he's not, the BABIP will normalize. Even if it goes down to like 320, we're talking about like 55 points off potentially. So we're talking about probably somebody who's going to hit closer to 250. I mean, I think the biggest reason to be excited is the drastic change in the K percentage. 25% down from, 32%, which was the previous year, is reason to be excited, right? Like, no one's concerned about 25% anymore. He's walking 12% of the time. So, I mean, we put that stuff together and things look pretty good. I mean, five home runs isn't necessarily the power I think we'd people had initially dreamed of when Soler was coming over from Cuba. And even with the early days with the Cubs, that people thought this was somebody who'd hit for more power. But I mean, you're talking about probably a 20 home run, a 20-80-80 type of guy, which is not terrible. He's probably not top 25 material, but especially with just two steals and not a whole lot of reason to think there's going to be a lot more than that. But, you know, he's going to be a guy who's going to probably get killed by the shift sometimes because he's, you know, pulls the ball over 50% of the time. You know, infield fly ball rate's really high, 13.5%. But I do believe that there is some reason to be optimistic in this profile. Still 45% ground ball rate, 33% fly ball rate. So he could be a player that would benefit from some launch angle change. And certainly might not hurt his batting average any. So, you know, I think he's a guy that deserves more attention than he's getting. Probably should be owned in 15 team plus, and is probably, I think he'll be in the 200 to 250 range next year in drafts.
Well, I want to notice one thing that I like in profiles and see if you agree with me. The one thing that Jesus Aguilar and Jorge Soler share is that they do walk. Within power profiles, guys who hit the ball really hard but are selective at what they're swinging at is something that I think is a very defined good skill. You know, it portends good things. I've always been amazed last year when they used Aguilar largely as a pinch hitter, how many times he would walk as a pinch hitter, because pinch hitters generally don't walk. I mean, they get off the bench. They're like, okay, I was called on to swing the bat. I am going to swing the bat. That is a general profile. Do you agree that pinch hitters aren't notorious for walking?
Yeah. I mean, as you noted, like the general idea isn't, hey, we're bringing you up, calling you off the bench to sit there and watch, you know, get to see four balls come across.
But he walked a tremendous amount of times last year pinch hitting, which I would, you know, only know from watching so many Brewer games. And that added up to a guy who is going to take pitches, but when he hits pitches, he hits them hard. So you take those two variables together and you say, well, he hits the ball really hard, swinging at good pitches to hit. That's something that I think is a skill that we don't look for enough. Like, I don't hear that on other outlets very regularly. Like, you know, how much is this guy swinging? He's making good contact at good pitches to hit. And I think that is what we're seeing a lot of in Soler. And I think when you look at 20 runs and 20 RBIs for Soler, he started out the year hitting at the bottom of the Royals lineup. He's hitting around AA to AAA guys at the bottom of that lineup. But, you know, by and large, I think that's a fair assessment. So, I mean, those numbers would be a lot better had, you know, they believed in him earlier in the season, which I don't blame them for. They wanted to keep the pressure off him. He's a very young 26-year-old, and I think he's going to be hidden in Kansas City, and I think you need to watch for him as a rising draft value. Not so much as a great player, but a guy who's going to be very good for where I think he's going to get drafted. And that's one of the things I really wanted to point out today about Jorge Soler. You know, we already covered Yonder Alonso to a large extent when we talked about the first baseman. But I am really curious. I've heard some interesting analogies, and I want to talk baseball in general about Paul Goldschmidt. When Paul Goldschmidt started off the season struggling, somebody asked me in the FWFB chat if I was worried. And I said, I think I'm a little more worried than most. My reactionary nature tells me that just because a guy runs doesn't necessarily mean that, that body profile, everything else means that he's going to age well. And on top of that, we had him as a sure thing going in. The price to have Goldschmidt, especially in early drafts this past offseason, before the Humidor was fully announced, the price to get him was often top 5 or 6 picks overall. And you add the Humidor into what we're seeing out of Goldschmidt, and I'm pretty concerned going forward. And we're going to have some fun with this. So why don't you go ahead and tell me where you are on Paul Goldschmidt and how much of a bounce back you're expecting here?
Yeah, I mean, Goldschmidt's interesting in the sense that his profile doesn't tell, like, I wouldn't expect, like, the Humidor, I don't think it's a large reason for the statistical outcomes of what we're seeing. He's hitting more line drives than he did previously. He's hitting, like, only 2% more fly balls, where he's where he's getting eaten up is a little bit higher in field fly ball rate. It's up 2%. But like the rest of the profile, like he's hitting more to the opposite field, pulling a little less and to center field a little less. He's just the soft contact hit rate has doubled over what it was last year. That's obviously going to be a concern, but I mean, Paul Goldschmidt's not a 201 hitter. I mean, nothing that he's done in the last 10 years tells us that he's a 201 hitter. Strikeouts are up. So, I mean, I think this looks like a guy who's pressing. You're seeing kind of the same, you're seeing the same walk rate, which is still great at 13.6%. I think you're just looking at possibly getting, 2016 Paul Goldschmidt with 2017 stolen bases, which is a pretty average. Well, maybe not. It's above average in the overall profile, but it's certainly not first round worthy. So, I mean, I don't know. I don't think anyone's selling on Paul Goldschmidt right now. I think if somebody drafted him in the first round, they're still holding on to him in the first round. But I think he's a player that if you have a need at first base or middle infield, that it's worth making offers on. Because I don't think it's going to stay this bad.
I think it's very unlikely to stay this bad. I think that's for sure. And I don't want people to misread what I said earlier about Goldschmidt, because he's certainly still a good player. The only thing that I see here that really, really concerns me is you wonder if he's made some sort of a reaction to the Humidor. Because have we ever seen a player? We're talking about a player who's dropped, 96 points in batting average from last year, while dropping 82 points in OBP. That seems like, his ISO went from 265 last year to a buck 60 so far in the close to the first 50 games this year. I mean, that is it's just it's a plummet that we haven't seen. Now, here's the one I like the most. Okay, basically, he's on pace, right, for 86 to 87 RBIs. He knocked in 120 last year. I mean, these are plummeting numbers like we haven't seen, and there's some interesting framework to try and put around what's happening. Okay, and I do want to put this in player context. Okay, if you drafted Paul Goldschmidt, okay, you drafted the only player taken out of the top 20 players who is sinking you, like he's sinking your teams like a rock, right? Partially because none of the other people taken, outside of maybe the injured Clayton Kershaw, none of those other people are performing poorly. Like, I'm not, you know, you haven't gotten exactly what you wanted necessarily out of, you know, Giancarlo Stanton, right? Stanton looks like the third coming of Babe Ruth compared to Goldschmidt right now. Like, I mean, there's like no one, you know, and when I put this in this context, it's partially because, you know, over and over again, you're going to hear people say, well, you know, that top group of players, you know, they've all been good. You know, basically whoever you took in the first round is fine. You know, that's the natural thing, with the one outlier being Paul Goldschmidt. You know, I do think maybe some of the picks in the, you know, the late second through the fifth round are being undervalued for how much they can be hurting you, the Byron Buxtons and what have you. But really, I don't know that we've seen this precipitous of a drop-off from an elite player. I mean, there was an argument. I heard arguments for him being the number one player taken overall this year. And he's the, you said the 27th first baseman.
Something like that, yeah.
I mean, it's the most obnoxious thing that I can remember. And
oh, sorry, the 47th, or where is he? Sorry, the 37th first baseman.
37th first baseman, and he was the first baseman taken off the board. I mean, in early drafts, not in drafts that were later after we found out about the humidor. And you're largely dismissing the humidor, and I think there's plenty of reasons to dismiss it, but I also think there's a reason to ask if this is mentally playing at some level.
Well. Yeah,
I heard as recently as what, like a couple days ago, he did not have a home run at home.
Yeah, I mean the Diamondbacks team, like for like they're the third worst right now in runs scored in Major League Baseball. Third worst as a team, they're hitting .217.
And when Pollock was healthy, Pollock was performing like vintage Paul Goldschmidt, like. Yeah. So, you know, and I, you know, Ketel Marte is what we covered earlier in the show as part of the reason. And, you know, that Chris Owings is another complete and utter mystery to me on how, you know, his minor league numbers looked really good. And then he struggled and he seemed to break out and then he struggled. And I mean, there's guys on this team that are just complete enigmas, and they're getting more out of their left fielder than I thought they were going to get. I mean, there's like certain little pockets. Now they did just get, you know, Jake Lamb back, and I think that, you know, can have some effect, especially with as woeful as they've been. But, you know, it's a very odd team to profile as well. I mean, you basically can't start one of their catchers because none of them play regularly. You know, their pitching was supposed to be really good, and for the most part,
it has
been really good, but not godly. Or, you know, their lefty strikeout specialist. Not those guys. You know, I mean, so it's been tough to, you know, and Zach Greinke is succeeding with, I don't remember a pitcher succeeding as he has to this point with regularly throwing in the mid-80s. Like, you average out his pitch speeds, and Zach Greinke is throwing in the mid-80s when everyone else is throwing at least 92 miles an hour in the bigs. That's what it feels like. I know that's not exactly accurate, but I mean, almost all of the excelling starting pitchers in the bigs are pitching at least, you know, low 90s or better. So there's a lot of mysterious things going on. And, you know, it's hard not to say that the humidor factors in a lot of what's going on, because there's just a statistical anomaly after statistical anomaly going on. And it's very, very odd. Like, AJ Pollock was in a power burst that we had never seen before his wrist avulsion. And, you know, some of these predictability factors that we've spoken of today, I want to hint at the fact that, you know, that we're taking improvements. We're looking at statistics so much more closely than we ever have before. And we're taking improvements like Ketel Marte's, you know, plate discipline last year. Okay. Well, and we're multiplying, we're saying, oh, well, this has got to be who this player is. And that's just not necessarily true, okay? Odubel Herrera is another guy, okay? Like, we thought we've known who Odubel Herrera is four different times in the last 3 years. And now he's what? I don't know. he is legitimately, what, a top two-round pick if we redrafted off the stats that we have so far this year. And he was drafted as, what, like a fifth or a sixth outfielder in shallow leagues last year? So I'm wondering aloud how we can take what we're seeing and try to go forward and draft as smartly as we can. Do you think I'm overstating that, or do you see my point?
Well, I see your point, but I'll also bring you back to something you said a little bit earlier, and that was largely the players outside of Goldschmidt in the first two rounds are performing as expected. Well, we'll say Goldschmidt. Well, we'll throw a couple other caveats in there. Goldschmidt, Anthony Rizzo, Clayton Kershaw, although it's not necessarily out of the realm of, like, no one would have said, like, there's no chance Kershaw would get hurt again this year. So, I mean, there's the statement's always made that something like 60% of first round picks don't end up at the end of the year aren't first round picks. So, I mean, I think the unpredictability is always there, and we just shuffle the deck on who's inside of that top, you know, say 30 to 50 players. I don't think this year is any different than last year or the year before, or the year before that. We just have a different set of players. We've got, you know, a quarter of our sample size. And when we come back to this, you know, come September or October, when we start really thinking about draft again, you know, we'll see where we're at, right? I mean, your three sport league has a pretty early draft to it. I would guess when you go back and look at like the top 50 baseball players that were taken inside of that draft, you know, this time last year, and then looked at that at the end of the year, there's some people that are going to look like geniuses, and there's going to be people that look like idiots. And that's the fun part about drafting in baseball, is that no one's ever completely correct, but no one's ever completely wrong either.
Yeah, I mean, and of course, the beauty of fantasy baseball is that a 162-game schedule has a tendency to accurately portray strengths. You know, weaknesses don't generally get hidden over a 162-game schedule. You know, and that's the beauty of the Major League Baseball standings. You know, that would be the soapbox that Matt Thompson would sit on right now and tell me, well, the Brewers can't cover this, their bad starting pitching all year. There's no way that these guys are as good as what they are, you know. At the same time, down to the player level is where that happens. Like BABIPs are going to tend to normalize in, you know, 90% of the sample size. You know, different things like that, home run to fly ball rates for pitchers, they're going to tend to normalize. And so it is fun to watch the season play itself out. It plays itself out like a novel, basically. Each season is a new volume, a new episode, which is fun. I still think there's a little something to some of the trends that are going on here, and I'm going to be watching very closely first base and middle infield, because these are seems to be where we're having the most major breakouts and the most major swings. I mean, we didn't even talk about Trevor Story lately, who's, you know, just on another tear, and another guy that went from, you know, people loved him the first month and a half of his career. People, you know, distinctively said he was done, you know, that he had been completely exposed for the next 6 months of his career. And then other people said, well, you know, maybe he's not quite as bad as everybody thought he was. And now this year, he's turning out to be really good again, especially from a fantasy standpoint, because we don't care if it's aided by altitude or not, for our fantasy numbers. But like I said, I thought this was a worthwhile discussion again, because I do think it focuses on a lot of the trends that are going on within fantasy baseball. And you know, we'll keep trying to adjust and keep trying to glean as much information as we possibly can from what's going on out there. That's sort of what our gig is, by talking about it every week. So, Andrew, why don't we make an abrupt ending to the show, and why don't you tell us stuff that you're working on right now, and give us your Twitter handle again?
Sure. Working on a couple things. Working on kind of doing a larger profile on Andrew Heaney, because he'd looked really good up to his last start for the year. He was kind of sitting in some elite company. So working on a profile of that. Also going to be putting together something, you know, the 2018 version of something I did last year, which was looking at the top 10 of each position in the ESPN Player Rater and picking out a guy I didn't expect to be there and giving you the my percent chance of him being there and then kind of chronicling that throughout the year. So those are a couple of things you can probably look for from me in the next week or so. And, of course, you can find me on Twitter at Andrew K. Dewhurst.
All right. Well, I'm Chuck Anderson, and I can be reached at Just Chucking It. I've got some external factors going on now that are making it very difficult for me to write as much as I want. But we seem to be adding some staff, and the staff that we have added is doing a really nice job of filling up the website with some very good good information for you guys. So make sure to check that out. I'm also hopeful a couple times now, twice in the last 3 weeks, I haven't been able to find somebody to do the pod quiz podcast for me. Or with me. So I'm hopeful that some of the new staff will chip in there as well. I had a really good player list last weekend, which included, before the weekend started, included Jesus Aguilar. So I was going to pronounce myself a genius for predicting him before a huge breakout happened. So anyway, thank you so much for your time and the listen. We'll keep doing everything we can to get quality content out to you guys. And thank you so much for your support. This has been a Friends with Fantasy Benefits concept podcast. And now we are signing off.